Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello. From the studios of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Byron Scott, your host for this week's discussion of world news events by professionals whose job it is to report the facts and analyze the consequences. Tripoli fell this week, and unlike in the Marine hymn, it was not to the United States Marines. Rather, the 42-year regime of Libya's Muammar Gaddafi fell to rebels from his own country, backed by NATO aircraft, as the United States, quote, led from behind, unquote. As a New York Times headline characterized it, the six-month civil war in Libya was a small war with big consequences. What are those consequences for the future of NATO, the European Union, American foreign policy, and for the Libyan people themselves? Here to tell us their experience and thoughts on these questions are, from Brussels, Terry Schultz, EU and NATO correspondent for Global Post. She was formerly State Department reporter for Fox News and also worked for Reuters, ABC News, and CNN International, and freelances for NPR. We hope later in the show to have Sebastian Meyer, a photojournalist and documentarian who has covered the civil war in Libya and whose work has appeared in Time, the New York Times, and Wall Street Journal, among others. He will be coming, we hope, on the phone later in the show. And finally, Neil McFarquhar, New York Times bureau chief at the United Nations, who starting at the age of 3 lived and worked for many years in several Middle Eastern countries, including Libya and Egypt. His latest book, with the fascinating title, The Media Relations Department of Hezbollah, Wishes You a Happy Birthday, is a bestseller. Neil, I'm not going to let you get away without explaining that title, but first talk to us a little bit about what the apparent winding down of the civil war means to the world community. Was this, as some claim, a new approach to international intervention?
Well, there's long been a debate at the UN about, you know, the responsibility to protect and the whole idea that the international community should intervene to protect civilians. And the people who won in Libya are going to say that this is an example of where it worked. You know, there's some others, namely the Russians and Chinese at the United Nations, who are saying that NATO overstepped the mandate from the Security Council, and it's just basically the Western powers muscling in. But I think that in the balance, you know, it's going to be seen as a success because it did allow, you know, a popular uprising to triumph.
And it did so with the troops of that own nation, as opposed to so-called boots on the ground.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it is seen as a you know, a Libyan uprising carried out by Libyans, and there is a secondary role by NATO in destroying tanks and so forth. We still don't know the conclusion. Obviously, it's a little bit messy. Colonel Gaddafi himself is still at large, but, you know, the rebels have carried the day.
Right. Terry Schultz, the NATO response was outside their traditional remit, or their Cold War remit, It was also not exactly unanimous, was it?
Well, it's also not the first time they've gone outside their remit. Look at Afghanistan.
Right.
I mean, that's a much bigger example. Libya is considerably smaller than that operation. But you're right; it wasn't unanimous. The Germans, in particular, were quite opposed to launching an air campaign, and they in fact didn't participate. And the Turks initially also didn't want to do this. You know, it's their neighborhood, and everybody needs to listen to them when it comes to places like Syria. But those objections were overcome. I would say massaged, basically a non-rejection of NATO assuming the mandate once the United Nations gave it to NATO. And that's one thing that was really important here for NATO. You know, the British and the French went in ahead of time before the UN decided that it was going to authorize a no-fly zone. Then NATO picked up the operation after that. But yeah, it was very interesting watching this come together. And as you said, now they're very much calling it a success.
Right. I understand. We have Sebastian Meyer on the phone now. Sebastian, you've been pre-introduced to our audience. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Good, Sebastian. You've been covering the war on the ground in Libya, and I want us to give us your impression of the human dimensions of that war.
I covered the beginning. I was in the east of Libya in March and April for about 7 weeks, and. So the line just cut a little bit. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you fine.
Sorry, the line cut on my end. I haven't covered any of the recent fighting, especially in the west, in the mountains, and obviously Tripoli, and now on to Sirte. Mm-hmm. But I was in the east, in Benghazi, all the way up to Ras Lanuf, and then also some time in Misrata.
And I looking at your website and reading your blogs, you had some very powerful experiences there.
indeed. I arrived before any of the NATO airstrikes began. So I was there while the Gaddafi airstrikes were happening. I think March 12th, I was very, very close at the Ras Lanuf checkpoint, having one of the bombs drop very almost on top of my head, and that was a really it gave me obviously a very clear idea of actually how dangerous the conflict was.
Mm-hmm. Neil, I want to. To ask you to give us some impressions. You wrote some wonderful, a wonderful article in the Times the other day about what some of the ramifications may be to the winding down of the war. How is it to go back to the scene of your youth? You lived there about 10 years, if I remember your biography correctly.
I keep hoping to make it back to Brega, but I haven't yet. Brega is a little oil town about 2.5 hours west of Benghazi that was set up by Esso in the 1960s to exploit the oil there, and so that's why I was there, because my father ran a refinery. And I did make it back to Libya a few times, but eventually I was banned by the Gaddafi regime for some of the things that I had written. But, you know, just looking at Libya and also the region as a whole, having spent so much time there, you just want to be, you know, optimistic that all these years of terrible repression in these countries is finally coming to a close. And I think, you know, Tunisia and Egypt went fairly quickly for the circumstances in those countries. And, you know, with Libya going now and at least the sort of statements coming out there about wanting a democratic country being fairly strong, we'll see what comes out. But if they do get, you know, real democratic countries in Egypt and Libya and Tunisia, it's going to start to sway the whole region.
Of course, it's been over 40 years since many international journalists have spent time in Libya. So it's really new turf for many of us.
It came and went. I mean, there were times when they invited everybody in. I mean, I was there in 2001 when one of the Lockerbie bombers came back, and, you know, they sort of invited the whole press corps back in so Gaddafi could spend hours and hours and hours at a press conference trying to refute the conclusions and the fact that one of them had been found guilty. But yes, it is new turf in a lot of ways, and certainly people are hoping a lot of the secrets of what Gaddafi fomented in terms of violence around the world in those years will come out.
Is this Terry Schultz? Is this some a new way of doing things or not? I think today may begin the rebuilding period for Libya.
Well, that's certainly what the rebels are hoping, and the international community too. This meeting taking place in Paris should be a real turning point. They're hoping that, you know, some of them, there will be more announcements made about money for the National Transitional Council or the Transitional National Council. It's said different ways in different places. And the EU, for example, has taken a big step today, and that is starting to lift some of its sanctions. It just announced a couple of hours ago that 28 companies have had their sanctions lifted, and some of those include the ports so that real commerce can start again. Some oil companies were under EU sanctions. And so I think everybody recognizes, the international community recognizes, that what comes after the bombing campaign is very, very crucial right now. And that means getting a real economy going. The council needs money to pay salaries. People need jobs. Or they're not going to welcome this new government, even if it's transitional. I mean, people really need life to get back to normal there if there's going to be any semblance of democracy and any willingness to tolerate some of the growing pains that are going to be seen there.
Let me interrupt here just for a moment. Before we continue this discussion, I want to remind our audience that you can view or listen to this program anytime by downloading our podcasts at globaljournalist.org. You'll also be interested in the articles, online discussions, and other features that are part of the website. You also can send us questions or comments, care of Global Journalist Program at gmail.com, or simply look us up on Facebook. Neil McFarquhar, let me get back to you. Is it your impression that we will have democracy or some version of it in the new Libyan government?
You know, it's just so hard to know, because Gaddafi spent 40 years dismantling virtually every aspect of that country. You know, there's no parliament, there's no civil society, there's no parties, and so people have to build everything from scratch. And you know, there's a great deal of mistrust between East and West. It's unclear whether the Transitional National Council is going to be able to bridge the differences, because they were all based in Benghazi in the East, and the West sort of rebels feel like they should be given credit for taking Tripoli. There's the whole question of sort of the Islamist element, because there was attempts over the years by militant Islamist organizations to assassinate Gaddafi and take, you know, to sort of put an Islamic imprint on the country. It's unclear, it's kind of murky what their role of this has been and how much influence they have. So there's a lot of questions. But I think just looking at Libya and looking at the region as a whole, people there, I think, sort of have come to understand in recent years, through a combination of factors, that they do live in a particularly repressive part of the world, that they are out of step with the world and with history, and they want that. Now, you know, building it from scratch overnight is a very, very difficult process, and that's the, you know, hanging question over it all.
Mm. Sebastian Maher, you glimpsed this and a little bit of the tribal politics and such that that Neil referred to. Let me ask you the same question: Is this a democracy coming along as you saw it on the ground?
One of the things that really stood out when I was there was the number of Libyans who'd either been born abroad or had been raised abroad coming back with very high hopes for democracy. What became unfortunately apparent on the ground as well is that there's a lot of tribal politics, and there is a lot of history there, and there's a lot of unknown. To be honest, I've been very surprised how much both journalists and politicians want Libya to be a success, to the point where they trust the Transitional National Council almost without asking any questions. I have great hopes for it, but I think it's not going to be as easy as we'd like it to be. I think there are many more factors at play, like Neil said, that still yet to be seen.
Terry,
I wanted to.
Yes, go ahead, Terry.
That point. That's one thing that struck me also, that the council we didn't even know who they were. I mean, we knew a few names at the top, but they were being welcomed. They were being recognized by the United States, by the European Union, by NATO. And I asked as recently as this week on Tuesday at NATO's operational briefing, how closely do you really want to hitch your wagon to this group before you know, before the full extent of for example, crimes that have been alleged by NGOs come out? You know, there have been Amnesty and others have said that the rebels also were committing atrocities on the ground. And the leader, Mr. Jabil, also admitted when he was here in Brussels about a month ago that some of these incidents had taken place at the beginning of the uprising and that they would be dealt with legally. So anyway, I asked NATO, you know, are you really confident in these people? And they basically said we have to be. And we've checked them out as much as we can. And another point I found interesting was that they said that these are people that are coming from very normal backgrounds. They're bankers and taxi drivers that just, you know, left their jobs and went in. That's why they were such a ragtag army. But he said that they're very normal people who just want to bring the best for their country. And we don't expect them to be particularly militant. I think in one sense, It's a bit alarming if you remember what happened in Iraq, where you know you had Ahmed Shalabi, he was the darling for years, and then suddenly the U.S. didn't really want to be best friends with him anymore. So I think that will be interesting, but they haven't had anybody else to count on, and so I think the National Transitional Council has benefited a lot from being the only ones there.
Hmm. And I know that Europe is getting. This was the question I was about to ask you before, is anxious in getting the Libyan oil flow back. The EU appears to want to take a big hand in that.
Well, I don't think they would put it that way. Of course, they want to be seen as much more benevolent than that.
Of course.
They did, as I said, they lifted their sanctions on the port and some oil companies today. So particularly as they are looking at possibly putting an oil embargo on Syria, which is literally happening as we speak. They obviously don't want to foreclose their options for getting fuel any other way. There are always problems with Russian oil too. So Europe is always in a state where it has to try to diversify its oil supply. So that's a key concern for them, and particularly for Italy, who had a very the largest investments in Libya of all the EU countries.
What is the view of Neil at the UN of the not exactly hands off, but background role that the United States took in this 6 months war?
Well, I mean, obviously there was a bit of a fight in the Security Council because, as I had said earlier, sort of Russia, China, South Africa, Brazil, India, all either permanent members of the Security Council or countries that would like to be took exception to the fact that they felt that the mandate to protect civilians would turn into an all-out war fought by NATO, and so that has made them, you know, they've just dug in their heels for any kind of action on Syria. I think they're all trying to put that behind them and now and come to some sort of consensus about the future role for the United Nations in Libya. There was some talk of, military observers if there was a ceasefire, but that seems to have been put aside. And now they're talking about basically three or four aspects, which would be, you know, help with organizing elections, humanitarian aid as they, you know, try and get the country working again, and then some form of transnational justice in terms of, you know, either the Truth and Reconciliation Commission or something like that, and then finally sort of helping day-to-day security by bringing in police trainers and that sort of thing.
What about Syria? You mentioned that. Is Libya a template for what the UN and NATO might want to do in the situation in Syria? There are certainly human rights issues there as well, of at least even larger numbers, at least.
It's a very different situation. I mean, Libya, in terms of regional politics, is very marginal. Nobody liked Gaddafi. There was regional consensus that the, you know, outside world should intervene. It's a relatively small country in terms of population, 6 million people. They are ethnically homogeneous. There's no sort of tribal or ethnic, I mean, there's tribal difference, excuse me, but there's not ethnic or sectarian differences. Syria is a completely different ball of wax. It's much more central to the Middle East. It, you know, resembles Iraq in that there's all kinds of, you know, sects and ethnicities. There's Sunnis, Shiites, represented by the Alawites, who are the minority that run the place, Kurds, etc. So I think there's a real fear in the region that it could much more closely resemble Iraq, because it would just shatter along all those sectarian and tribal lines if the central government falls. And also in Libya, there was this transnational national council, even if people didn't like it or were suspicious of it. It did sort of have a constituency, and that doesn't exist in Syria either. People are very afraid that there's just, you know, if you push Assad over, there's no alternative, and then so you do end up with Iraq. And, you know, then there's regional consequences. Iran is a close ally of Syria. The Israelis would be nervous about what would be happening on their border. So there's just the potential for a tinderbox there is much greater, and I think that's why you won't see what happened in Libya happen in Syria, unless the levels of internal violence, you know, are raised much, much higher.
Really, no chance from coming from NATO. They're not even thinking about it. In fact, there's as Neil says, I can't even imagine what levels it would have to get to bring NATO into this. It's just not going to happen, and that's one of the problems. Assad knows that. And I think he feels, you know, that he can withstand some sanctions, and he's not going to be bombed by NATO, which gives him emboldens him with what he's doing on the ground. And is also, if I were a Syrian activist, I'd be out on the street saying, "What about us? Why not us? Why the Libyans?" But they must know that NATO is not going in there. And I would mention that just yesterday, the Syrians are trying to put together some kind of a national council, but the fact that it just started yesterday just backs up what Neil was saying. They've named an academic in Paris who apparently didn't even know he was being named to head this new group until he saw the list published. So that's just something I read yesterday. So they're a long way from being organized enough to take over Syria. But Syria is a long way from falling, too. So, not the same situation at all as Libya, I would say.
Mm. From your observations on the ground in Libya and in Iraq, where you spent a great deal of time, Sebastian, do you agree with those evaluations?
Yeah, Syria is not a country I know particularly well. But yeah, the thing that really stood out when I arrived in Libya was, although the tribal differences run extremely deep and are, you know, have a very troubled past, there is no sectarian divisions. It's a very observant country. It's a strong Sunni country. There's a unification and identity based around Islam that you don't have in Iraq at all. I cannot see Libya turning the way Iraq went in the same way Iraq went, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I do. And we're running out of time, but Neil, I'm not going to let you get away without explaining the title. Media Relations Department of Hezbollah wishes you a happy birthday in your new book.
Well, it's the entire book sort of looks at agents of change across the Middle East, and it was sort of inspired by the initial push toward democratization and looks at some of the hurdles that, you know, activists are going to face in terms of overcoming the power of police, secret police organizations that run most of these countries, et cetera, and there has been this groundswell that has swept some of them away. So the other aspect of it, of course, is that there are sort of militant groups that have their own idea of what it should look like, and one of them is Hezbollah, but Hezbollah also has this incredibly sophisticated outreach and public relations department, and when you do any reporting in the areas they control, namely in the southern suburbs of Beirut or South Lebanon, they make you fill out this sort of five-page form of where you went to college and what your mother's name is, et cetera.
So you get a birthday card, huh?
Is your birthday.
No, that's great.
And then on my birthday, I opened my computer, and there was a little poem from Hezbollah at Hezbollah.org.
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm reading that book right now, and I would certainly recommend it. It is a good read. I want to thank our guests, Neil Farquhar, Sebastian Meyer, Terry Schultz. And I also wanted to mention that in introducing last week's discussion of the sex scandal coverage, I erred in identifying Dominique Strauss-Kahn. He is, of course, the ex-president of the International Monetary Fund, not the World Bank. Our director is Travis McMillan, audio by Pat Akers. Our lead producer for this show was David Cawthon, assisted by global journalist producers Ryan Kress and Jessica Popovec. This is Byron Scott for Global Journalists, reminding you that you can download, view, or listen to this show, plus additional features, by going to globaljournalist.org. Join us next week as journalists open their journals to take us inside their stories. And now, stay tuned for the latest edition of Free Press Watch.
And now, Global Journalists Free Press Watch, where each week we bring you a roundup of major events in press freedom around the world. I'm Jessica Popovec. This week's reports come from the Committee to Protect Journalists. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir announced Saturday that he would free all journalists detained in that country. So far, only one newspaper reporter has been released. However, at least eight other journalists are still in prison at this time. All of them are believed to have reported on Darfur, a highly sensitive topic for the government. The Sudanese government hasn't issued any official pardons, so whether the president's promise will be fulfilled remains to be seen. And in Venezuela, a daily newspaper's owner and top executive were charged last week with inciting hatred, insulting a public official, and publicly denigrating women. On August 20th, the paper published a satirical article claiming that several high-ranking female politicians performed in a cabaret directed by President Hugo Chavez. The story was accompanied by a photo montage that superimposed the officials' heads onto the bodies of dancers. This week, a federal judge ruled to allow their paper to resume publishing. However, the criminal charges against the paper's leadership remain. And in Egypt this week, jailed blogger Michael Nabil Sanad continued a hunger strike he began on August 22nd. Sanad was tried in a military court for, quote, insulting the military, and is now serving a three-year sentence. His hunger strike is a protest against his alleged mistreatment at the hands of military prison guards, as well as the delays in his appeal process. He has been in a military prison since March 28th. As always, you can find links to these and other stories on our website at www.globaljournalist.org. On behalf of everyone here at Global Journalist Radio, thank you for joining us.